Thank you, Julia. So you just heard her talk about how organizations are digitally transforming, fundamentally changing their product proposition, changing the way that they engage with their employees, and also optimizing their operations. But now it's time for us to hear more about a topic we know a lot of you are concerned about, your number one concern in some cases, security. And if you lay awake at nights worrying about the security of your organization, this next session is definitely going to give you a chance to gain some insights on how to stay protected from our number one security leader here at Microsoft. But before we bring him out, here is a brief look at the important work that his team is doing.
Technological advancements have dramatically changed the way we communicate and share information in our personal and professional lives. And with these advancements come corresponding risks of exposure. We've seen a rise in the sophistication and regularity of cyber attacks around the world. The responsibility to protect the information in our care has become increasingly critical. With so much information online, it's our job to ensure that it stays secure. Unprecedented attention on cybersecurity has created an opportunity to accelerate the way we educate, innovate, and solve problems. Together, we must advance security so that people everywhere can continue to transform our world.
Please welcome Microsoft Worldwide Corporate Vice President and Chief Information Security Officer, Brett Arsenault.
How is everybody? Really? Is that a good talk on digital transformation and then I get to come excite you with a security talk? I used to be the last conversation every time. Now I'm the second conversation. So there's a lot to talk about with security. And people, this is really a from a boardroom to the backroom discussion. How many of you have a CISO today? How many of you are looking for a new CISO? Okay, good. Good to know. The idea was to share a little bit about the experience of being a CISO at Microsoft and a little of how we think about the problem in our digital transformation. Later today, Jim, our CEO, will come talk to you about our own digital transformation and our movement of our line of business applications to the cloud, and security played a key role in that. So what I wanted to do was spend a second just really talking about how we think about the problem in two areas, from boardroom to backroom. So in this scenario, first is what is the role of the CISO? And it's an interesting one for me. If I think about it, this is basically, we do this based on sleep patterns. And so the CEO should be comfortable and able to sleep at any time. The CFO at quarter end usually has a little bit more intrepidation, but they generally sleep fairly well and unrestricted. Our chief digital officer, who has a lot of operational, does not sleep as well as the other two. And the CISO just isn't allowed to sleep at all. And this is an important fact, because if your CISO's sleeping, then other people aren't. So you want to make sure that's a key part of this. But as I think about really this, what keeps me up at night, because that's the question I usually get the most, the question I ask is, for me, it's actually fairly simple. Once I broke this into a simple model, it's from Sun Tzu, The Art of War. But basically, this idea of how we think about honoring the past, being honest about the present, and frankly, having hope for the future, which a lot of the digital transformation helps me with. And I'm going to walk you through how I think about that from a technological and a board perspective, if that makes sense. So starting with that, I'd like you to be more engaged and excited about our conversation. It's all packed in. It's amazing. This is like, have you been to those movies where you can determine the end and it changes? Has anyone been to one of those? They're actually kind of interesting. So you get to change how this is going to play out. We have put envelopes, one red, one yellow, one green, under your chair. So we, depending on that, if you go and look under your chair, pull those out, we'll determine which order we're going to go with. Anybody find it? No. Thank you for proving you've all been successfully fished. So, sorry. You're what keeps me up at night. No. This wasn't meant to make people feel silly or stupid, but or any of those things. We have wonderful education awareness programs. It was to relate a story and to really highlight this is part of the problem, which is how do we help users not help hurt themselves? It's a totally reasonable thing to click on an email that says I love you when it's a message from your mother. Right, and that's a almost 20-year-old virus issue that we have. And so how do we think about that capability? So this relates to a story that I had about 2 months ago. I got a mail from one of our executives, I won't say which one that was on that board, and they said, I think I was just phished, I realized it, and I need help. Awesome. Tell me what you did. I got a piece of mail, and I clicked on a link. Okay. Not necessarily terrible, but let's see what's happening. What'd you do? Well, I was asked for my username and credentials. Okay. You didn't put them in, though, right? I don't remember, which is an interesting answer to that question. So we, of course, assume in that scenario that they did. The good news was when they realized they immediately went back and changed their system password. So that was taken care of. But here's the interesting part that plays out about past, present, and future. The mail should have never got to her her or his inbox. Make sure I'm careful. That's PII, right? It should not have gotten to the inbox. And normally, when these things, we would catch it. This is a specific example. But the interesting part was, we said, okay, great. Jay changed the password. We feel good about it. We are in the process of implementing multi-factor authentication everywhere, right? Because this idea of know something, which is username and password, is interesting. Know something, have something, which for us, we have smart cards that everyone uses. And with Windows 10 now, we implement that via Hello for Windows. So it's awesome. You don't have to carry a badge, but you get the same know something, have something capability. You get five times fewer prompts. Users love it. I love the security. But that's still a know something, have something, which means people in foreign areas or remote locations can't do things because they have to physically have access to something. So that's helpful. But know something, have something is the present. For us. I know for many companies they're still coming up to that. The right thing is know something, be something. Right? That's a much more powerful thing because I can give you my card. Is that Mark? Hello, Mr. Sunt. How are you? I know Mark Sunt, a wonderful gentleman. So the know something, have something though can be transferred. The know something, be something, whether it's retinal, bio, or others not. So driving to the know something, be something and integrating that immersively is the right way to do it. But here's the most interesting thing. When we looked at and deconstructed this particular piece of phishing attack, what we noticed was it was targeting other people. And in the old world, we would go and remove it from all of our messaging servers. It was trying to communicate with another resource called the command and control, C2. And so we immediately go to our firewalls and our routers and we shut all those things down so nothing can communicate if it actually got through. And that's all wonderful. But we also noticed it was targeting over 10,000 other companies. And it was spear phishing. It wasn't broad. It was specific people within companies. So what do we do in that scenario? And in the old world, it's interesting. Of those 10,000 companies, approximately, I'm using approximate numbers, a large percentage of those people actually have relationships with Microsoft and have a TAM. How many of you have a TAM today? Awesome. So what would happen, for those of you who raised your hand, if you have a TAM, and we have our premier support, this is the technical account manager, for those of you who don't, if we have our premier support organization call your TAM and say, hey, we saw this thing coming after you, you should go do this to your Exchange server, you should go do this to your firewalls, and you should go do this to your routers. How long is it going to take for your TAM to go do that? Just ballpark me. You raised your hand. A couple of months. An honest answer. Honest about the future, hopeful for the, honest about the present, hopeful for the future. It will take time. Because one, the TAM has to go find all the right resources, spread out across the IT department, all the other things that happen. The great scenario in this case was, so how do we notify? Well, one, we make it publicly aware. We put it on our security site and our blog that this is an active attack happening from this actor, and people should go do it. But that assumes someone's watching that intelligence and all the other things that are happening. So that's not as good as if you get a call from the TAM. But in this case, with all of our O365 users, we could immediately go find this messaging and remove it, put it into a junk folder, notify your people that we've already done it, as well as update any of the C2 elements that were happening in our platform, and particularly on our Azure platform. So in this case, we go from months, days, weeks, whatever, minimally hours at the best case scenario, to almost instantaneously, when we find something, we can go protect the entire ecosystem writ large because of this intelligence graph and the way we build it in. So it gives me great hope that we'll be able to go do those things. But it's just an example of the different way of thinking and how we work through this. So that was just a story about how I think about that and a chance to fish you. I apologize. The second piece then is what are the boards thinking about and what's driving this? So I'm going to go back and we'll play. I love this information is beautiful site. And this is an example of the types of breaches that have been going on since back in 2005. And you'll notice a pattern, and I'll just let it play through. It's a wonderful pattern. I'm not picking on any companies. This is all public information. And what do we see? What's that? It is all the time. What else do we see? We see cloud. We see cloud. Yes. This is an interesting, this is a wonderful example of using data to tell the story. So this is the thing that's pushing board conversations, and I advise a number of boards around the world on the cyber discussion. So I'm going to share a few minutes on how we think about the conversation with the board and how we think about what we want to go do. Does that make sense? Is that okay?
Yep.
Okay. So on the board side, that trend is what's concerning the board. In the U.S., it's also what is providing opportunity for the Big Four. Right, there's a very different, in the last 2 to 3 years, the Big Four and the audit firms have a very different sense of interest and goal in making sure that their responsibility from an audit perspective, that they're doing the right things and making sure that all the risks are aware of. What was in that data view, again, was public, which is the frequency of incidents is going up. And I can say I witnessed an over 120% increase in the last year personally of attacks, attempted attacks happening. And the impact of which the number of records that are being disclosed or being compromised is also going up. And so does that mean CISOs are bad? Maybe. Or does it mean there's some things we need to go do differently as we go forward? And so part of the problem is in this situation is how do we address that and how do we ensure that we're doing the right things, but the one number one board question is, you know, can you prevent a breach from ever happening? And any good CISO knows the answer is no. But how do you respond and how do you govern and risk against those things? And so here's a set of about, these are the 6 to 8 questions that I see every time at every organization and every board I've gone to, which is number one, can we respond effectively when an incident happens, which is the right way to think about it. It is not to be in this idea, can I prevent it from happening? You do everything you can to prevent it, but the differentiation between everything you saw in that last slide is how effectively do you respond and recover from the incident? And that's an important thing to think about in this model. Do we have the right talent and organizational structure? That's easy for me. I just check and see if my badge still works when I leave the board meeting, so that's not too hard. But it is a fair question the board should ask. Do you have the right people on it? And when they say, do you have the right people on it, this is super important, not within your organization, but within the partner and the supply chain you use. How do you integrate with the supply chain and the partners you're working with? Are we on top of related legislation and regulation? I track 340 or so regulations globally to understand if there's changes and impeding and things coming better, and more importantly, has there been adjudication against it? That's not enough. That's an area where I need to do more, ability to see around corners on legislation. Julia mentioned the GDPR stuff is a good example. We have a plan, we have a model, but could we have seen it coming sooner? That would be great for us. I would say it was prescient, as Julia mentioned, if you think about the number of data centers we're building globally. I would love to say it's because we knew this was coming, this whole digital xenophobia that's happening globally. But what I will say is it gives us an unbelievable ability for you to know that you can put data in country where you are and meet most of those privacy requirements that you wouldn't be able to do on other platforms or cost effectively on your own. Do we have the right governance structure to minimize the risk? This is key. You can't get rid of everything. This is no different than any other risk, strategic risk, legal risk, financial risk. You manage it, you don't eliminate it. So do we have the governance structure to know we're working on the right priorities? Do we have the cyber-focused culture? I will tell you, Microsoft, as Julia mentioned, this $1 billion, which is not my budget, is one part of the focus that we have, but we have monthly meetings with our CEO and his staff on security every month, on what's going on, what we're doing, what we're seeing, and how we want to impact it. I think we're doing a pretty good job in that space. How do we measure effectiveness? This is a key thing. This is probably the hardest thing with the board is the measurement model. Some people will use various internal tools. Some people will use different technical control standards, like you could use COBIT, ITIL, ISO 2001, 2000, or I'm sorry, ISO 17001, 17002. There's a lot of different standards you could use. We have a governance model that we do, which is a risk model, and that's just a standard risk perspective. And then we do believe, and about 50% of organizations today are using the NIST cybersecurity framework as the model. They're measuring the capability and maturity of their program. And so that's a trend we see continuing to happen. And then how does a CISO prepare for what they don't know? This is the hardest question. So what I'll share with you is the one thing that we had in working with the boards that I've worked with, including ours, was we did a bunch of research on CXOs and the language they want to use around security. And the most frustrating thing, and you probably have had this yourselves, is security, particularly CISOs, tend to fall into 4 buckets. or have four responsibilities. They should be managing risk, they should understand technical architecture, they should understand how to do operational efficiency, and they should most importantly understand how to do business enablement. And many of the old school, in the past, CISOs are all about technical architecture and all the technology pieces. CISOs of the future and present good CISOs, which I can name from a number of financial institutions and others, understand this balance between the four. You take risk to enable the business, you drive operational efficiency so you can invest in more things just like you would in any other part. And depending on the cycle of your business will depend on how much time you're spending in each area. And this last question, when we did this research with CXOs and the conversation around security, we found people were still having way too many technical jargon conversations on security. So we changed, for many of the companies I work with, we changed to a very simple model with the board, which is we only talk about three things, and most boards have a lot of financial people on them. We talk about technical debt. We talk about accrued liability in terms of security, which is what decisions are we making today that will become technical debt if we don't make the right decision. So how are we future-proofing the company from security things that are going to happen? Examples, massively distributed data centers because we know privacy legislation is going to continue to be on a nationalistic phase. That's one way you future-proof the company, is you ensure you have the ability to let data be in-country. Smart, good decision, seemed expensive at the time, now it seems prescient. Right? And so what are you doing to future-proof the company is the second discussion. And the third discussion is, what is the governance model you use? How do you measure risk? How do you assign and prioritize resources against those risks? And that's the only three conversations we have. There's no three-letter acronyms in it. I thought there was no jargon in the one I just read for another company. There still was. There was some internal knowledge about names of projects. And it's a fairly straightforward approach. Again, technical debt, future-proof the company, and what's the governance structure? So those have been the most effective with many of the Fortune 500 company and boards I work with, including our own board. So that was just a sharing on what we hear and how we think about that conversation. But let's go back for a minute and think about the graphic you just saw. Because the interesting part, and probably the frustrating part, so let me step back just for a second. How many of you have war for talent in your organizations? No? You all have all the talent you need, no shortage? What's the single most restricted talent you're trying to find today? Is it? I'm just curious, and don't pander to my role. Data architecture. Oh, data architecture. That's a really good one. Data. What else? Engineers. Ooh. Yes, as we become digitized and we do the digital transformation, there's more and more engineering talent. And DevOps also is sort of driving operational pieces into our development environment. So you hear engineers, data. What else?
BDI.
BDI? Virtual desktop infrastructure. Yeah, if you're doing virtualization, that would be totally true. Totally true, which I think is an awesome segment to work in. So interestingly, statistics will show. So for my own org, I'm really lucky. I have the most amazing team of people who work for me. And I know when I'm riding on someone else. Like, there's a question as a manager, are you helping lead the team be better, or are you just riding on their coattails? I'm pretty sure I'm just riding on their coattails. But they're unbelievably good at what they do. But a few years ago, we decided two things we were really missing. We needed much better data talent because of the massive data. We look at 20 billion events a day, and it's a needle in the haystack problem. So how do we get much smarter about the data? So that was one huge thing for us to go figure out, was the data piece. The second piece, as we thought about it, was, again, more in the response capability. In my world, business continuity, disaster recovery, and service resiliency reports into my function. And we did that for a reason, which, again, is the ability to respond and recover is going to be as important, if not more important, than the protect and detect side of that equation. And so finding talent on the data side has been very, very hard, and I find that true. But finding security talent has been even harder for me. And so today it's less than 0.5% in the IT space of unemployment rate for security people. So it turns out hiring people who are super smart and ask lots of questions and are super interested in data is more important than the security skill, because I can build the security skill into them. Whereas before, I was always just trying to hire a security skill. It also is this thing about being honest about the present, which is I need to go build a whole new set of skills, and we're working with universities to go do that. But finding people who can balance that is really, really hard. The other thing is Julia mentioned the interesting. So these security people who look at 20 billion events on my team, and if you've been to the Cyber Defense Operations Center, you've seen it, is really incredible. And it's part of the funnest part of the job is finding these interesting things. The sad part of the job, though, is there's the pedestrian part of the job. So if I believe that because we have all this technical debt, what am I doing today and going forward to actually address that? And this is the simple view to look at it. All those bubbles you saw slide by, the data will show you today that still 90% of those would have been preventable if you just did the pedestrian part of my job. Not the APT, not tracing down people in foreign nations doing terrible things, just doing the hygiene. Most of those go away. And that's the sad part. That's the thing about cleaning up the technical debt in the tail. Now, we've all done this. We all have end-of-life systems, legacy systems, keep them current. And the one thing I'll say that's been different today and as I go forward is I don't do the patching. The IT department does the patching. I tell them when and what has to be patched. But patch and OS concurrency, if you do these five things, patch, OS, AV, this isn't just Microsoft, all products, all services, all OSs, all applications, and good identity and good monitoring. Those five things would have prevented 90% of what we saw happen. That's a pretty sobering statistic that the hygiene is still really important. So how do I make that better? So for me, in this cloud space, and Julia mentioned this for a little bit, what we did is as we move, and Jim will talk about this today, we're about 65% of all of our line of business applications are moved to the cloud. Our software as a service applications, like OneDrive for Business, messaging, Skype, and all those things have all been moved to the cloud. So all that patching and OS concurrency and antivirus and all those pieces are all just done for me. I don't have to do any of that anymore. So the one lever that had the most impact has now been offloaded to my cloud provider, including whether I'm using ServiceNow or Marketo or something else. And so, again, when you ask what kind of talent do you have, it's important to know what the agreement is you have on the other end of that contract, and that's critical. But that means I have resources being freed up to be applied to other parts of the business. Identity and monitoring are a little bit more expensive and a little bit more difficult to go do. And so on the identity side, we're in the hybrid model, where I'm actively moving most of my Active Directory to Azure Active Directory so I can move it to the cloud. And again, identity is about 35% of my team. And I'd love to move that to a cloud service for all the pedestrian parts of it. I will still do the deep analytics. The thing that tells me when an employee, which happens, because disaster recovery works in my team, we do physical security, when I have a flood in Chennai, I know within 6 minutes what people were flown into the area, what people were in the buildings, what people, which is why it's important they use our travel system, not just to save us money, but because I can protect you. When there's a terrorist attack in London, I know again where people are and how to protect them. So integrating that identity system, not just for giving you access to applications, but to mine it to make sure we're protecting our people is critical in how we go do that. Things I couldn't do before cloud services in an efficient or effective way. So identity is moving that way. Hopefully in a few years, I'll have very little identity on-prem. And monitoring will be the last thing. Monitoring is the hardest thing for us to go do. I get a wonderful capability from the services, but the correlation of those events is super, super important. And so I want to spend a second. So the hygiene part, this is what I'm doing today, but in the future, I see more and more of this, I think Jim will tell you, we'll try to get to 90% of our line of business applications being our cloud service. There are some things I still have to do on-prem. As Julia said, that's why the hybrid model is there. It's not just a transitory period, which is for sure true, but it's also critical because there's some things I need to be able to bootstrap physically. There's some things I have to do with physical because of security requirements or government requirements. So not everything will go, but most everything we're having is moving there. But here's the key. Remember the slide that showed the CDO kind of sleeping restlessly? So what do I do with all those resources? Do I give them back? Do I save money? This is my only plea with you. No, what I'm going to do is I'm going to redistribute them to go work on the really hard problems, which is the 10% of that stuff that you can't solve with the simple hygiene stuff, right? Which means I'm shifting the mix of my talent pool for people who are hunters and people who are doing their resiliency built-in work and moving all that stuff over. And so one of the keys that gives me hope for how we can do that hunting effectively in the future, and this is this boardroom to the back room, is the fact that this intelligence graph that Julia spent a little bit of time on. People will talk about intelligence and machine learning and AI as being there's like this direct correlation to the size of the data you have being relevant to how effective the data is. That's kind of true. It's not really true, though. You can have a massive amount of data and still get lousy. If anyone who does any statistical analysis knows, you can still get lousy results from it. And so what's interesting is you'll hear lots of people talk about machine learning and AI as a function of the size of the corpus of the data you're looking at. And much like diversity is the best way to have the best results in a workforce, but diversity by itself is not that interesting. It's the inclusive part of diversity where you bring the ideas and you share and you use and actually leverage those that are interesting. It turns out the same analog is true with data. So AT&T, Verizon, Orange, pick your company, most of the network carriers have unbelievable speeds and feeds. They have great access to large amounts of data, but they don't have diverse data. And so the one thing I think that's interesting about Microsoft, and I think about why I'm hopeful for the future and how we can detect these things, is that we have great network data. We have these data centers around the world, so we have great geographic data. We have cloud service data that includes industry perspective because various industries are in those clouds. We have software as a service data. So, you know, we do 300 million authentications every month, a billion auths a month, 300 million email messages get scanned for spam all the time. And so you have data that's very applicable to a workload, to a geography, to a service load being in the Azure data center, and at the device level. And so nobody else has that diversity of data, right? I could pick out the competitors we have and you can think about it. Some have good device data, some have good cloud data, some have good app data, but no one can pull all that data together into a single view. Now what that tells you is I have diverse data. The key is how do I make it inclusive, much like, again, on the workforce side. And so the ability to correlate across those systems is unbelievable. And so I'll give you just one example of the things we're doing today. And this is not meant to be a product pitch. The teams sell and you buy your products. And at first, I thank you for buying your products because I'm a cost center. I have a job because you buy our products. I love my job. I love my team, so thank you. But I don't have anything to sell you. I can just tell you the things I'm learning in protecting this global company. In Windows 10 with Windows Defender, we put a bunch of telemetry in this thing called Windows Defender ATP. The security operations center that you'll visit, that is the one tool I can't pry from their hands anymore. Because I get intelligence feeds from around the world and from my environment at things I just could never see before. And in and of itself, it's amazing because what it gives me is a great ability to find things. What's interesting in real world is I will see something that's not right behaviorally. Not a known bad, it's behaving in an interesting way and it raises a flag for me. I look at it, I see it, and it turns out there's a payload on this machine that shouldn't be here. How did it get here? And so interestingly, that payload allows me to reach immediately and see that it came from a message and immediately reach over to the exchange service in their advanced threat protection and track through the messaging system how it got here, where it happened. And again, I can go shut it down everywhere it happens, not just in my tenancy, but in other ones if it's appropriate. And so now I'm taking device data, applying it to the service, and integrating it into a single view that lets me go track that through. So literally things that took me days to do, I can now do in less than an hour. And so my team is challenged with one thing. You can only come talk to me about any resource if you're either going to show me how you're going to make me more effective or more efficient. And with this diverse set of cloud and the security intelligence graphs that we're building, and again, it's the inclusive side. How do you take the Azure data, the Exchange data, the SharePoint data, the Yammer data, the Windows data, the Mac data, and tie that all together in a way that I can actually see that happen at scale and auto-remediate it? That's the key. So finding it's awesome, but then how do you auto-remediate it? And you have to be in this recursive cycle where the data can then go feed, hey, this turns out this is a problem. We should make sure there's an update to Windows, and Windows should ship that update, and that update should automatically come down to your machine. And it goes right back to this question here. Do I have to patch, or do I just update your devices for you? And so again, this is a capability we didn't have 5 years ago before cloud services existed. We didn't have it because we hadn't put that kind of telemetry in Windows, which we now have, and we're expanding that capability. And so again, I would say I'm very excited. I do have to honor the past. There's things we can't fix. And so there's things that we have to quarantine and isolate and work in that space. Where we are today is a much better place than where we were 4 years ago, but we have to start taking advantage, and this 50-50 cloud is secure and more secure has to go to 95% more secure, 5% less. And so I feel good about where we are. I feel good about the teams I have and where the technology is writ large, but my ability to do the future is going to be based on three simple things. And again, it's simple. Number one, there cannot be any authentication in a system that's not multi-factor auth. And it has to be done in a way that's easy for the user so the user's not even aware of it, right? Because the person who clicked on that fish and entered their passwords, I'm responsible for them having a behavior where they ever see a screen that says enter your password. If they see a screen that says password, they should know something's wrong. It should just be as simple as a bio piece that gets done, and we're doing that today. Number two, any device that connects to any service, because the network is no longer a reasonable place to do security, you have to have it at the endpoint and you have to have it at the identity perimeter. So whether you go to Exchange, whether you go to Marketo, I don't care where it is, the service has to be able to say, is this device clean before I let you on? And we do that with conditional access. And lastly, from that monitoring perspective, I need all the services to provide me with intelligence graph. And all those things are either right here or coming. So I feel very good about why I have hope for the future. So with that, I'll say thank you. And the question people always ask me after is, how do I get your security team to work for me? It's simple. Use our cloud services. Thank you.